But I do think that there are some things that we can do directly to create the new political momentum that will make for a better world for all of us. And that is, first of all, to really understand the idea that the resources of the world inherently belong to all of us. And if that's the case, then what do we have to do politically to change the circumstances in which we don't have access to those resources, and we don't have direct decision-making power into how those resources are managed? So that really has to change. That power has to tilt in the direction of the people themselves. So anything that will expand and preserve democracy for the future, I think, is a really great thing to get involved with.
Hello, everyone. I'm your host, David Minot II. This episode is based on a show from a podcast that the Planetary Makeover team worked on entitled Share on the Air Radio. In it, you will see host Cirito Pascual interviewing James Quilligan, an analyst and administrator in the field of international development for some 48 years now. Together, they're discussing the current state of economic affairs in the world and how it can evolve into a more equitable system that benefits both the people and the planet. James Quilligan is the co-founder of the Global Commons Trust. It fosters the development of commons resource trusts, sustainable currencies, and public banking. Mr. Quilligan, who is also a student of the Ageless Wisdom teaching, and host Cirito Pascual discuss how a more equitable approach to managing the world's resources will incorporate into our world and the global community the spiritual principles of justice and sharing. James Quilligan has worked at the international and the grassroots level to help create sustainable economic systems. He's also worked as a policy advisor and writer for several prominent world leaders. In the early 1980s, James Quilligan worked on the Brandt Commission, named after Chancellor Willy Brandt of West Germany. And there he was able to inject into the commission's report a little bit of influence from the Ageless Wisdom teaching and mankind's elder brothers, the Masters of Wisdom, aka the planet's spiritual hierarchy. This is a group of perfected human beings who are overseeing the planet's evolutionary development. And they're not some untouchable remote group. It's really just you and I, a couple hundred or a couple thousand years from now. At that time, we'll have the same role. This knowledge of the Ageless Wisdom teaching helped James Quilligan inject into the Brandt Commission a bit of the Ageless Wisdom teaching perspective, namely sharing, peace, and justice as a way to ensure the future of humanity and the planet. Now, this is important because at that time, the world was still grappling with the paranoia and hostility of the Cold War, as well as the rise of neoliberalism, which was rearing its ugly head and contributing to inequality and suffering around the world. James Quilligan points to a more democratic approach to managing the world's resources to help sustain the planet, as well as the stability, health, and evolution of the human communities that depend on those resources. And here is host Cirito Pascual and James Quilligan to explain this in detail.
Welcome to Share International Radio. Welcome to all our friends around the world. My name is Cirito Pascual. I'm podcasting from Seattle, Washington. I co-host this podcast with Diana Gold Holland, who I'm happy to share will be returning next week. Today, we have a very unique a guest with a very unique perspective of the world because of his work. So on to our guest. I'm really excited to have him join us today. Not only is he a student of the Ageless Wisdom Teachings, but for the past four decades, he has been working tirelessly at the international level and at the grassroots level to implement strategies that can create an economically sustainable system for the world. And he has tremendous insights in how we can bring about those changes. Early on in his career, he worked with the German Chancellor and Nobel Peace Prize winner Willy Brandt on the Brandt Report, which has been described as the most comprehensive and solutions-oriented analysis of critical global economic issues. He has served as policy advisor and speechwriter for global figures, including Pierre Trudeau, François Mitterrand, Jimmy Carter, Tony Blair, and His Royal Highness Prince El Hassan of Jordan. And in the many years of his career, his work and ideas have been informed by knowledge foretold by the Ageless Wisdom Teachings that humanity's elder brothers, the Masters of Wisdom, along with the most senior member of this group, Maitreya, the World Teacher, are emerging now onto the world stage to guide and inspire all of humanity into an unprecedented transformation. I am happy to introduce to our audience James Quilligan. James, thank you for taking the time to join us.
Thank you, Salito. I'm looking forward to having a talk with you today.
Yes, and my intention for this episode is to connect what you have seen, what you are seeing happening in the exoteric world out of your experience, and connect that with the conviction that you and I and millions around the world share, as I said, that the Masters of Wisdom are emerging into the world and that humanity is on the verge of tremendous positive change. It's hard to believe that after listening to the news at the opening, at the top of the hour before this show, but let's focus on the evidence that we know is there. But first, let's get an idea about your background. Talk about how you first came to work for German Chancellor Willy Brandt, and what did that lead to for you?
Thank you. I was invited to become a research assistant with the Brandt Commission, and that led to a lot of other opportunities to develop my career at the international level, and I've never really looked back. It's been a great education for me, but along the way, I've been able to have a little bit of influence on some world leaders in terms of their use of language, their conceptual models for international relations, and so I've, as an advisor, I've been able to have a little bit of impact behind the scenes.
What drew you to the work in the first place? What was inherent in your upbringing and education that had you come to that place of work?
Well, first of all, I was always good with language. And secondly, I got very interested in political affairs when I was young. I was very deeply influenced by the Limits to Growth book, which was published in the early 1970s. And it basically said that the world in 40 or 50 years, about 50 years, would be running out of resources. And that that could lead to really desperate conditions. So when the opportunity to work with the Brandt Commission came up, I took it because that was a way of preventing this kind of depletion of resources by creating a cooperative international structure to share resources. And the more resources could be shared, the more they could be conserved. And so I saw great opportunities in doing that, and I began to move in that direction.
In In Share International, there's a quote from one of the Masters of Wisdom. He says, when the world's goods are shared more equitably, half of man's problems will vanish overnight. And this was published, 30 years ago in October 1985 in Share International magazine. What do you think that means exactly?
Well, it's pretty clear that if we share resources, we're solving a lot of problems at the same time. We are reducing the gap between rich and poor. We're reducing the friction of class society. We're taking the edge off of racism and religious intolerance and political ideologies. And we're also doing something very positive for the environment. So in working with the Brandt Commission, I had the opportunity to write the introduction to Common Crisis and also do some editing of the book, which was the Common Crisis was the second book published by the Brandt Commission. And the introduction is supposedly written by Willy Brandt, but actually I wrote it. So in December of 1982, when the book was published, the last line of the introduction says, could we not begin to lay the basis for that new community with reasonable relations among all peoples and nations and to build a world in which sharing, justice, freedom, and peace might prevail? So to me, I was really directly paraphrasing their teachings and trying to inspire people to recognize that sharing was the key to the future. And that was in 1982. Little did we know at that time that we had already embarked on an age of neoliberalism. We knew that Reagan and Thatcher and Helmut Kohl had been elected into office on a decidedly right-wing platform. But we just thought that that was a political agenda, and we had no idea how deeply that would reach into the institutional framework of the world. And here we are years later, and we can see that the international institutions and the domestic institutions are tilted in the direction of not sharing resources. There was a time when we thought foreign aid was the key to sharing, as long as we raised our aid budgets and began to distribute aid across the world, that that was really the key to making things happen in the direction of sharing. But in fact, it's not. And that's the direction, however, people were looking back in the 1970s and 1980s.
What was the shortcoming of aid?
Aid is tied, meaning it's tied to political objectives on the part of the people who are giving the aid. So if we are giving aid to Africa, it has strings attached to it. It means that we are expecting certain things in return for giving that aid. And it's a complicated situation, and every aid package always has strings attached, but they're always different, and some are more stringent than others. But it's not an act of generosity, as most people think. But in fact, that was part of the premise of the Brandt Commission's report, was increasing aid. And there's nothing intrinsically wrong with that. In fact, it does show a level of generosity. However, giving aid in a world which is so inequitable does not really level the playing field. It doesn't change the institutional framework or the intrinsic structure of the way political and economic decisions are made. So it really is just an expression of gratitude that doesn't really change the system. And besides that, it's not always an expression of gratitude. It can be an expression of cynicism when foreign aid is given with objectives in mind, which benefit the donor.
I'm going to quote from Benjamin Kremp, chief editor of Share International magazine. He published in February 1982 that there is a group of high initiates who are themselves economists industrialists and financiers of tremendous reputation and achievement who have developed, with the help of the hierarchy, that's the Masters of Wisdom, a series of alternative plans which will solve the redistribution problems which are at the heart of the economic problem. These plans can be implemented immediately as soon as humanity accepts the principle of sharing. So we're going to just kind of bookmark that quote for a second and circle back around to what you were talking about, James. You know, when you were working, obviously, during the 70s and 80s, early in your career, when you were working on the Brandt Commission, the world was structured along the Cold War division. And so when that fell away, those divisions changed. And I have a question from our listener who knew you were going to be on, so he sent me a question, Bill in Northern California. And I wonder if it ties in to how our economics have shifted from the Cold War to today. He says, the economies of most Western developed countries are now heavily financialized, which means that unelected technocrats and central bankers have a powerful influence on a nation's domestic policies. So his question is, how do you see this affecting a government's ability to meet the needs of its people?
Well, I think that hits the nail on the head. That financialization of economics is exactly what I was referring to by neoliberalism. And it's really developed very strongly since the early 1980s. Actually, it really started in the 1970s. How does this affect our ability to create policies of greater sharing? Very good question. That's really the dilemma that we're all facing right now internationally. The Brandt Commission had recommendations, foreign aid, greater sharing of technology with emerging economies, a new international monetary system, a new international financial framework, all geared toward reducing the inequalities that exist in the world. But where do we stand today? We're moving into this disastrous Trans-Pacific trade agreement. There's a similar agreement between North America and Europe on the table. These are not steps in the direction of greater equity at the regional and local levels. These are actually going to be a new phase of this process of neoliberalism. So I think there is a roadmap toward a more equitable future, but it clearly doesn't exist in most of the plans that are being put forward right now by the international community, at least in terms of what we see emerging through the G20 and through the G8, or what's now the G7, since Russia has been kind of kicked out of it. Maybe some, you know, later in the conversation we can get into some of those solutions.
Yeah, so let's circle back around, because you are a student of the Ageless Wisdom teachings. You were introduced to the ideas as expounded by Benjamin Krem in the 70s, again, early on in your career. Describe how you came to hear about Benjamin Krem and how that information resonated for you.
Well, I had begun to work with the Brandt Commission, and somebody said, hey, there's a group in London that's saying something very similar to what you guys are working on. And I told my colleague, well, how do I find out about this? And he said, well, it's a friend's meeting house on Euston Road in London. So I went to check it out. That was in the fall of 78. And then I, you know, really got deeply involved in Share International, and I was very taken with the message of Benjamin Krim. But you know, politically speaking, I wasn't really able to speak about that with my colleagues because people just weren't ready to mix spirituality with economics. And in fact, Benjamin Krim had told me at the very time, said, don't mention this to Billy Brandt or anybody else. So I didn't. And that was a wise decision. As I got older, I started, you know, crossing over and beginning to say, well, you know, to tell politicians, you know, that there's got to be a spiritual purpose behind what you're doing. And have you ever considered it? And on a few occasions, I've opened up and told people I was working with about the esoteric background. But by and large, if I thought it would serve a purpose, would I do that? Otherwise, I could lose my position because some people don't really get that side of the analysis. Some people are extremely left-brained and really want to do things by the numbers and by logic, and they don't have any quarter for spirituality. So that's I've kept it separate, but I've also mixed it up because I realized that spirituality sooner or later had to influence directly the language and the conceptualizations that these politicians were formulating.
And can you talk about, obviously you are not extremely left-brained. you had openness to the information that you heard from Benjamin Krim, but it's still a leap. What did you experience that told you this is information that is relevant? The idea of, you know, masters, elder brothers of humanity entering into the modern world to guide and inspire humanity is as humans, we'd like to think we can take care of everything ourselves and we don't need any help, but somehow you found it relevant. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, I had already been reading the Alice Bailey books. So when Benjamin Krim came along, it was a new level of understanding for me. But at the same time, I had come to believe over a period of time that the quote that you read earlier about a group of financiers and economists and thinkers in the world who were out there making master plans for sharing of resources, I did tend to believe that that was in existence, whether it was on a higher level of thought that hadn't really precipitated down into the actions of politicians or not. I believed that we were on the course to have that realization. And in fact, like 40 years later, I still believe that that's ahead for us. But I also don't think, however, that those immediate plans were in some storeroom or some locker or some hidden away in some vault somewhere. I do think they were actually thought forms that enlightened financiers and economists could tap into. And I think that's what metaphorically was meant by the quote from Benjamin Krim as well as other people. Because consider that the generation of people that he was talking about back in the early 1980s and the generation that is referred to in the Alice Bailey books, which was written much further back than the 1980s, most of those people are all passed away now. So yeah, there is it a particular generation of people who, or is it rather the idea that higher level initiates are who have access to this information will actually begin to change the world in a more enlightened way? And I tend to believe in the latter. Particularly as because all this time has passed, and I'm still, you know, I'm still looking in lockers and vaults and in back rooms for the master plans, and I haven't seen them.
That's you answer a question that's been in the back of my mind for years. I have been following this information not as long as you, but for a considerable amount of time. And I have wondered, because years are going by and, yes, people pass on. And so I appreciate your insight on the idea that the plans can exist on a mind belt that perhaps a younger generation is intuiting now and hopefully will be ready to step forward to implement. And I want to mention, since we're talking about world leaders in the minute before the break, if our listeners go to share-international.org, which is the main site of all of this information, you can find the story relating to a major event where world leaders met in London. I believe it was in 1991, April of 1991, about 225 world leaders gathered, all of whom had known about Maitreya prior to this meeting. And apparently Maitreya had organized this meeting and led the meeting, and these world leaders, including media figures, witnessed Maitreya appearing and disappearing before their eyes, and they had other experiences to know that their own personal experience of Maitreya was not private, that it was shared with many other thinkers. So there's an area to investigate for our listeners. James, I'm going to now bring us to the topic of the commons. You shifted away, as you mentioned earlier, you shifted away from the perspective of international development, and you focused, your focus now is on the commons. And I just want to share a quote from Maitreya just to lead us into that topic. Maitreya, in one of his messages, said, "Sharing and justice are central to my teaching. Wherever the light of these truths shines, I turn my eye, and through the channel of that light do I send my love. Thus do I work. Thus through you do I change the world." We'll keep that thought in mind and talk about the commons. What are the commons, James?
The commons are all that we share in common through our birthright as human beings. So when we were born, or let's put it this way, historically, before there was private property or government regulation or government control over land, people did share their resources in common. They governed their resources in a way by making decisions for the best management and sustainability of those resources. So it involved rules for cooperation, which the group decided in and of itself. So it didn't always work perfectly, but it certainly worked more efficiently than what we have today. And today, we scarcely know what the meaning of sharing is. Earlier I said that sharing and foreign aid seem to be equated in the minds of politicians, but that isn't the case. That really has very little to do with sharing our commons. So the commons are all the things that we have in common. We have a lot of examples of commons, public libraries, public parks, national parks, the oceans, the atmosphere. But we recognize that when the commons are unregulated, then there can be problems. So that's where governments and private sectors step in to help to regulate those commons. However, it takes the power away from the people themselves to manage those commons. So that's the dilemma that we're facing right now universally. However, the challenge we really face is that people don't even know what the commons are. But this is where it really ties into the spirituality and the quote from the Maitreya that you were discussing earlier, that the light really does shine through when you begin to see that all the things in nature are meant to be shared. They're not meant to be hoarded or privatized or regulated by government. And again, you know, what I want to stress is that there's nothing wrong with corporations, nothing wrong with governments. But they do have to give greater power to people to express their democratic decision-making over the management of the resources in a much more powerful way than has been happening over the last few hundred years. And I think that's the evolutionary course that civilization is on right now. Little do we know that, but I do believe that that's the course that we're headed in.
So do you think governments alone and corporations alone will give greater power to people, or do we have to seize it from them? It seems like from what you described earlier, the future, like from all evidence, seems quite bleak. How will we shift to have people having greater power and decision making in their communities and their lives?
Well, the first thing I think we have to do is really get back to the roots of democracy. If people themselves at the local levels are going to be making decisions over their own resources, we have to have a greater political voice. And that's why I really believe that spirituality today is about not just meditation, but about activism toward the greater sharing of resources in the world. I said earlier that the Limits to Growth book published in the early 70s was a great influence. It was the first major computer analysis of the world's resources using mainframe computers that were available back then, long before the days of PCs. And what it indicated is that if humanity didn't change any rules or regulations in the world, if we just drifted into the future the way we were headed, that we would be running short of resources around 2030. And we are rapidly approaching that. And I would submit that the tightening up of political regulations and the heightening of racial tensions, the militarization of the police, the greater rise of terrorism in the world, a whole host of problems have been created in the international zeitgeist as a result of humanity anticipating in advance that the world is growing smaller, and with it the share of the resources is growing smaller, particularly as the global population increases. In my view, this is going to lead to a great crisis unless we do indeed begin to share our resources, because wars for resources are the very thing that the governments are bracing themselves for right now. And so the militancy involved in the heightening of tensions across the world is a result of the recognition, which is slowly dawning on people across the world, that our resources are indeed getting more scarce. Now, so in an age of sharing, we can reverse that. We can actually begin to enlighten corporations and governments that we're all in this together. We can't waste any more time like we have been over the last 50 years, when the recognition was on the horizon that these resources would be shrinking in their availability for the mass of humanity, particularly as the population rises. So there you have it. We're either going to have to enter into an age of greater cooperation and sharing of resources, or it's going to be very difficult at that point, in my view, for humanity to be able to even invoke the externalization of the hierarchy, to use terms known to some of your esoteric listeners. It's going to be hard to expect divine guidance, in other words, if we fumble the ball. And I think we're well on the way to fumbling the ball, but at the same time, that is really what the crisis itself precipitates, our invocation of the this externalization of the hierarchy. So I have great reason for optimism. However, every day that goes by, the clock continues to tick, and we are approaching the day of greater and greater crisis in the world.
And that ties, what you're saying ties into the statement coming from Share International connected to the Paris and Beirut attacks, that that event actually evoked in humanity a sense, you know, in an ironic way, actually more an invocative cry has been coming from humanity to use terms that that the masters are responding to. The masters and Maitreya, as I understand it, are poised to emerge into the world, but certain conditions have to be met, namely that humanity is prepared to share. And apparently, from the recent tragic events, humanity has demonstrated its longing for unity, for love, for synthesis, for understanding, and enough of that has been expressed. I am assuming through all the media that humanity expresses through, whether it's Facebook or the news or etc., enough of that has been expressed to open the door further for Maitreya's emergence into the world. So that is a very, very positive development. And some people would say, well, why didn't Maitreya stop the attacks? And something to point out that is a humanity's divine right, divine gift, is the principle of free will, that that we are free to choose the course we go on, and no savior is going to swoop down and take us out of harm's way. We have to take ourselves out of harm's way and rebuild the world, which is really what we are talking about now, in those ways of rebuilding the world. We'll start talking more about the Masters of Wisdom and how you think they're working, what you see working in the world, inspired by their presence, James. Any quick thoughts?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. I do think it is about invoking a greater sense of justice and peace and sharing in the world. And I do think there has been a greater awareness. However, I would say more so in Europe than in the United States, it would seem to me.
That you know, we have this presidential election coming up, and we're hearing things coming out of people's mouths that don't sound very generous or humane or thoughtful.
No, so it is to the contrary.
Very, yeah. Very puzzling. I was just looking at something that you said in an interview, and I'm curious about it. You say the institutions of property rights and sovereign boundaries are severely impeding the flow of conscious energy among the people and nations of the world. What do you mean by that?
Our opportunity to share, our access to resources across borders, is severely curtailed by sovereign boundaries, that is, political boundaries, national boundaries, national borders, as well as the stipulations of international trade, which create tariffs and protectionist policies that keep certain products out of certain countries. So that's really the key to breaking down the barriers that lead us to greater democratic management of our commons. I think what's going to have to happen eventually is that a union, a new union, not an industrial union of workers, but a union of commons networkers, is going to have to form to be able to institute the kinds of needs and demands for sharing that are so pervasive now across the world. You look at the crisis of immigrants at the moment. Immigrants are completely without rights. They're homeless. They're victims of extreme weather conditions, and yet they're called political extremists. This is a really horrendous kind of situation. But it spotlights the fact that, you know, we can be comfortable behind our sovereign borders, and yet the the dilemma is that we can also do things like sending drones across borders and not think anything malicious about it, because it's so it doesn't take the blood of our soldiers, so nobody's in harm's way that on our end, but we kill all these others across the border. So what I'm getting at essentially is that we're not going to transcend the level of sovereign borders or the level of, or the institution of having corporations anytime soon. And I don't express any desire for militancy and a revolution to bring them all down. But they are going to have to give greater space to a democratic voice of the people of the world for the sharing of resources and begin to recognize that the profit motive is not leading to that. The current prescriptions for sustainability of resources through the marketplace is not leading to that as it's presently conceived. So we have a lot of work to do in getting the flow of energy to flow across borders in a more direct way so that we are really, truly sharing resources.
So let's bring us to the work of the Masters and Maitreya. We talked about all these different aspects of obstacles and aspects of change, and it can be overwhelming to know where to begin. How do you see, you know, we are saying that the Masters are emerging into the world now, actually influencing world leaders now, and yet we still have just all the conflicts we're having. What do you envision if, you know, I'm sure we can't really imagine until it happens, leading up to the day, what is called the Day of Declaration, where Maitreya will speak to humanity through the world media. What do you envision taking place as the Masters emerge into the world? What do you think they're doing now? And where can we see evidence of their work, or what can we do as people to hasten that emergence?
Well, I really don't want to speculate on what I think the Masters are doing now and the part that they're playing at the moment, because it's too controversial, and it would just be my own opinion essentially. So, but I do think that there are some things that we can do directly to hasten the externalization of the hierarchy and to basically create the new political momentum that will make for a better world for all of us. And that is, first of all, to really understand the idea that the resources of the world inherently belong to all of us. And if that's the case, then what do we have to do politically to change the circumstances in which we don't have access to those resources, and we don't have direct decision-making power into how those resources are managed? As is well known in the United States and in many countries, it's corporations that are really controlling governments, in spite of the fact that we have a democratic apparatus in which people vote for their elected officials. When the decision making really comes down to it, it's often the corporations who are lobbying behind the scenes that are making the decisions on the management of our resources. So that really has to change. That power has to tilt in the direction of the people themselves. So anything that will expand and preserve democracy for the future, I think, is a really great thing to get involved with. Because you can consider this, too, that the ideals of democracy are so eroded now through the corruption at the national levels, at the governmental levels, that we could be facing the loss of democracy in the countries that presently enjoy it. And that would be a tremendous setback for humanity. It would set us back centuries or millennia, in fact. And if we did that, we can't afford to sacrifice the inroads that we've had over the last few hundred years with the development of democracy. And democracy is far from prevailing across the world. But we're not going to be able to share resources until we have a full spirit of democracy and a real authentic democracy expressed in the management of those resources. So it seems to me that working to build democracy at local and regional levels is where people need to go. And there are lots and lots of examples of that happening right now with transition towns and urban gardens and co-ops and the range of things that people are pretty well familiar with that are happening across the Western world, and actually in many cases across all the world, where people are getting a new spirit of camaraderie. And of course the internet helps to facilitate that a lot, because the networking of people, not just in local communities but regionally, is now possible. And I think that's a very good thing to move ahead. And of course the second point is that we are degrading our environment rapidly, and that is causing this loss of resources, as well as our own consumption of those resources is also contributing to that environmental degradation. The new spirit of local communities and regional communities getting together and managing their own resources is also going to mean that we're going to create safeguards not only for social equity, but also greater sustainability of the resources. And that's very important, because we have to guarantee that the resources not only meet our needs now, the needs of all people today, but also 50 years from now and 100 years from now and beyond that. And on the pace that we're going right now, we're not making any inroads. We're not taking any safeguards to move in that direction. We've got to be able to do that.
I hope we have young people listening who are making decisions about where, what area of study they'll go into. And I hope something you've said will inspire them. Young people and people of all ages. Some of us are making changes in our lives to be to devote more time to make greater change. In the last 2 minutes that we have, which is not enough, can you talk about your experience of transmission meditation? We mention this all the time, transmissionmeditation.org. It's a service meditation to humanity, and you've been practicing that for as long as you've been paying attention to the information of Benjamin Krem. Can you talk about that experience and how that's affected your outlook and your service to the world?
Well, people often ask me that same question. What do you get out of this kind of meditation? And the main thing I can tell people is that it really expands my creativity. It's not that I sit and think about like what I'm going to be doing next or tomorrow or something like that. But what I found is that the ability to sit in a silent space for a particular period of time with other people and download energies from, let's say, upstairs or from the higher realms opens up my creativity immensely. So the greatest thing I've noticed for me is not only that you build the dynamics of a meditation group and you're able to have greater impact in the social setting, but I do experience a huge burst of creativity and new insights and new intuition as a result of doing this practice.
James, thank you so much for your insights and presenting reality and possibility.
Thank you.
We'll have you back again.
And here is a prayer for the new age. I am the creator of the universe. I am the father and mother of the universe. Everything comes from me. Everything shall return to me. Mind, spirit, and body are my temples for the self to realize in them my supreme being and becoming. As most of us are aware, our world has arrived at a moment of profound transformation.
As millions call for peace and justice, many are seeking ways to help serve the world, and at the same time looking for an effective means of personal spiritual development. Transmission meditation is a way to do both. Introduced in 1974 by a master of spiritual wisdom, transmission is a group meditation that makes available the benevolent energies pouring into the planet in an ever-mounting rhythm and potency. Transmission groups worldwide receive and transform these energies sent by a group of extraordinary teachers, the Masters of Wisdom, led by Maitreya, the World Teacher. Thus stepped down, these energies can be used in the betterment of all life on Earth. This meditation also has a salutary effect on the individual participating in the meditation. It is safe, scientific, non-denominational, and will not interfere with any other religious or spiritual practice. In fact, it will just enhance them. So it's for the religious and non-religious alike. So now, just focus your attention at the chakra center between the eyebrows, called the Ajna Center, which is the center of the will. And let's read together the great invocation and meditate as long as you wish, holding your attention there when it drifts away by thinking Om silently, inwardly. The Great Invocation. From the point of light within the mind of God, let light stream forth into the minds of men. Let light descend on earth. From the point of love within the heart of God, let love stream forth into the hearts of men. May Christ return to earth. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide the little wills of men, the purpose which the masters know and serve. From the center which we call the race of men, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Let light and love and power restore the plan on earth. Visit us on Facebook at #PlanetaryMakeover. This show has been a production of PlanetaryMakeover.org. At our website, we have a link to our latest bi-weekly Planetary Makeover show. Shows are organized by category or by most recently produced show. For more background information, visit www.shareinternational-west.org. That's www.shareinternational-west.org. For related books, DVDs, and CDs by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the world teacher Maitreya, please go to share-ecart.com. That's share-ecart.com. We also invite you to watch another show that we really love entitled What in the World is Happening. And that show, which you don't want to miss, is produced by Share International Canada. Please view episodes of What in the World is Happening on demand at youtube.com/@whatintheworldishappeningnow. It live streams mostly on the second Saturday of every month at the Share International Canada Facebook page.